I'll open up the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and we will open up the work session on House Bill 2053.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2053 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It permits state agencies and or Native American tribes or agencies of Native American tribes responsible for the welfare of children to request criminal records checks for the purpose of licensure, certification, or registration to provide foster care.
Thank you, Regina. We heard testimony on this last week. I think there are no opposition. I'd like to have a work session on this today. So, Representative Gomberg.
Madam Chair, I'd move 2053 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 2053 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right. Those with the opinion that House Bill 2053 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye, and the opposed, no. And Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
Excused.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Wisnan?
Aye.
Representative Witzes?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gomber?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Excused.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. With that, the motion passes. And who would like to carry this? Any volunteers? Representative Gallegos will carry. Terrific. Thank you. With that, the bill passes, and Representative Gallegos will carry it. And we're going to hold off the hearing on 23, or the work session on House Bill 2349. We're moving on to the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2712. And we have a panel of people who have signed up to testify.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2712 has no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact. The statement's not yet issued. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It directs the Department of Human Services to establish recommendations for general assistance programs to serve low-income childless adults with disabilities.
Great. Thank you, Regina. Okay, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and with me, Philip Kennedy Wong, who's going to go first, and his PowerPoint.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong with Oregon Food Bank. Also here on behalf of several organizations that have a deep interest in a program called the General Assistance Program. Hopefully, yep, you got the PowerPoint.
Excuse me, why don't you keep the drapes open? So we don't, can you do that? Okay, terrific. I'm sorry, Phil, that I interrupted you, but I hate to feel we live in a cave.
Well, first off, we want to thank you for the opportunity to present before you on this issue. As I said before, very important to organizations that are working with populations that are very vulnerable. And this is something that many of us have been working on for several biennia in order to find a way in which we can help essentially the most vulnerable Oregonians that are disabled and unable to work. So we have two panels before you today. What we want to do is first give you a quick overview of the General Assistance Program, and second, a quick overview of the legislation that you have before you, and finally, most importantly, a panel of nonprofits and social services, as well as clients that will share with you their stories as to how they're working with these vulnerable populations. So with that, let me quickly begin. Just to remind folks, this is a program that is designed to help people who are applying for federal benefits, and I'm not going to go through each item here, but you'll see what the eligibility requirements are. And in Oregon, the last estimate that we had is roughly 2,993 people. So that's close to 3,000 people that would be eligible for this program. And as you can tell, it just from what you'll hear upcoming in our panel is that it does take some time for the application for these federal disability benefits to be approved. And in that time, that is the time that's most vulnerable, I think, to these populations in which they don't have any other recourse as far as support. And then again, just a quick several bullet points. I'm not going to go through them line by line, but I just wanted to give you a sense of what the program that once existed in the state of Oregon, it's actually still on the books, but this was a program that, as you know, did exist and did provide that sort of bridge for these individuals in this application process. And then I'm going to turn it over quickly to John Mullen, who will give you an overview of the legislation before you and why this legislation we see as important for moving forward the discussion to help these populations.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'm going to keep my remarks brief because the people that are here today to give their stories are really compelling, and we want you to have a chance to hear them. But we did have a very good hearing during the interim, and we thank the co-chairs at that time for allowing that to happen. But a number of you are new to the committee. Now, we've had a chance to touch base with all of you about general assistance, so we could give you a general assistance quiz and we would all pass. But just to remind you very quickly, general assistance has deep roots that goes way back to the Depression era. And actually, the last count that we looked at the last information that's available, 31 states still have funding for general assistance programs, and Oregon is one of the states that does not. We eliminated the funding back in 2005. And as the chair and others who were on the committee are aware, we had hearings in 2007 to restore the program, again in 2009. In 2011, we said we had a bill before the committee, but we said we would take a different tact and try to look at a way in which we could get a discussion going about the impact of general assistance, about not having a program in place, and what that meant. So what I would just mention about that is that since 2000, and even since 2005, when the program didn't get refunded, a lot of things have changed since then. We have the winding down of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Homelessness continues to be an issue that we talk about, and we see the need continue. There's been an interest, of course, on the part of the governor, but many others, on public safety and what we do around public safety. And we know that without having a general assistance program in place for these categories, it makes it very difficult for people to be self-sufficient. We've also focused some on the population that's age 55 and below the Medicare and Medicaid age, that also fall into a place where they have difficulty if they can't work and they have disabling conditions. The whole health care transformation that has happened wasn't around in 2005, and we now have coordinated care organizations that are responsible for person-centered care, and among their charges they have folks that have no income and no place to live, and general assistance could be a very important tool there. We also know that nationally and also in Oregon, there's been quite a focus on mental health issues for a whole array of reasons, and this committee has spent time talking about those issues in a variety of ways this session. We know that the disabling conditions that people have are physical, but they can also be mental, emotional difficulties that prevent people from working. The recent updates, and I have an even more recent update than Philip gave, about the people who are on presumptive Medicaid, we have 3,010 people currently on the caseload. These are folks that are eligible for Medicaid because they have disabling conditions, but they are eligible and get the Oregon Health Plan, but what they don't have is the cash assistance and the case management to help them get the Social Security or SSDI, Supplemental Security Income benefits, federal disability benefits that they could get. So with all of that, just what we are hoping that the committee will ultimately do is pass House Bill 2712, because really what the bill does is it's now saying we want to have this discussion across departments and with other stakeholders about what are the impacts on other systems by not having a general assistance program in place, and what can we do to revive the program, not only for the funding, but potentially looking at a pilot project and a little bit of a new direction for the general assistance program. So with that, I'm going to just end my remarks from here. I'm going to stay close by in case there are any questions. I'd be happy to address them. And if the Madam Chair, if you would like, we can go ahead with the second panel.
That would be great. That would be Jessica Larson, Ron Deason, and Carolyn Sterling, right?
Yes.
Good.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. It's an honor to be here today. My name is Jessica Larson. I'm a housing advocate at Northwest Pilot Project in Portland, Oregon, where we work with folks who are 55 years and older, who are at risk of homelessness or currently experiencing homelessness and are disabled. At Northwest Pilot Project, we work to protect our most vulnerable from medical crises and housing instability and homelessness. But Oregonians who can't get access to their disability benefits are facing real desperate choices and dangerous circumstances. In my past 7 years of working at Northwest Pilot Project, I've come to see a growing number of Oregonians waiting for their disability benefits. This wait is often over a year and sometimes longer, like up to 3 years. During this extended wait, people's health will decline because of the stress of their circumstances and inability to access the medical care that they need. They will risk homelessness because they have no income to pay their modest rents or keep their light bills turned on. Many folks end up sleeping outside because they learn the shelters themselves have very long wait lists. And people in these circumstances often end up going to emergency rooms for medical care because they're not connected to medical services and can't stay healthy. And they're in the emergency room, they're admitted to the hospital and must stay longer in hospital care because they have no safe place to go and heal and recover. At Northwest Pilot Project, we keep track of folks we know, clients working with our agency who are in the midst of this very long wait. We keep track of where they are sleeping, how long they've been waiting, and how at risk they are, how vulnerable they are on the streets. We use this list to prioritize our resources so we make sure that we are helping the most at-risk folks. But this list is very long of people waiting for disability benefits while disabled with no income and no other resources. The list is so long that most people are not getting any financial help from our agency and are having to figure out how to get by on their own during this extended period of waiting. It's an honor to be here today and introduce you to two really wonderful people we've gotten to know through our work at Northwest Pilot Project, Mr. Ron Deason and Mrs. Carolyn Sterling. Both have experienced the pain and loss of becoming disabled, only to be followed by the fear and anxiety of losing their savings and their personal resources to get by while waiting for their disability benefits. I'm grateful to each of you for being here today to share your very personal stories and humbling stories. So thank you, and I'll pass it off to Ron to introduce yourself to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Ron Deason, and I want to thank you folks for giving me a chance to explain myself. Chairperson Tomei, thank you very much. I experienced quite an ordeal in the year 2005. I've been a building contractor in the state of Oregon for over 35 years. I built reputable houses. They weren't just your apartment complexes. I built for people such as Don Scholander, Senator Passantini, the Tonkins, and just names like that, just to give you an idea of the quality of construction. To move it forward, on 2005 in May, I was rolling some floor joists on a building we were putting up. I slipped and fell, and I was impaled on a piece of rebar through the back of my right leg. In the process of that, I broke an elbow and destroyed some vertebrae in my back, and I was told that I wasn't going to be able to walk this and do that. Well, I couldn't accept that, so I gave it my best shot. I got a little gimp here and there, but I can walk around pretty good and go fishing, so everything's okay there. But the biggest problem I had was the time frame. I owned my house, and when I received my workman's comp settlement of $15,000. I was told ahead of time that there's going to be a little battle ahead, so to be sure to use your money wisely. So I paid my house off. I own a manufactured home, so you got to understand I still pay rent space. In the process of the time that it took for everything to engage, I was becoming behind on all my rent payments. I was making as much as I could to give them what I could because I had very, very special landlords. These people worked with me. They understood my situation and did as much as they could without involving their business too deeply. It carried on and carried on to the point to where I had to give up my trailer. I gave that up because I owed space rent. I wasn't sure through my attorney how long the disability factor would take to kick in. And so she said to get ready for a year financially of hardships. That year was tough to do, but I had enough money saved up and things were paid off to where that was fine. When the year came up, I started getting behind all over again, and my paid off trailer came behind on the back rent. So long story short, I lost my house. To survive in the meantime of no funds coming in, I sold fishing gear, personal things, just nail guns, compressors, things to get by on to survive. I'm very fortunate being that I live by myself, so I didn't burden anybody else, thank goodness. After losing my house in July of 2012, I moved up to the woods and stayed in my truck for 7 months because I didn't know who to turn to, and pride kept me from turning to, basically. I stayed up in the woods for 7 months, and the winter started getting closer, and I got sick. I could not get better because I contracted pneumonia, and I tried to do what I could do to stay better. The stress, the situation, the not knowing what the next day is going to bring, just it got the best of me. So I had to move back down towards East County, Troutdale-Gresham area, and stay along the rivers and places there to where I wouldn't be asked to leave because I'm loitering or anything. And in the process of the disability and all, it ended up taking almost 3 years for me to get my disability payments. In the process of not getting those payments, I didn't know where to turn or who to turn to. I heard on the streets to check this program out, which I did, and this is what introduced me to Jessica's program. Thank God they saved me. I had a warm place to stay for 2 weeks in a motel. I had 4 months that they paid all my expenses in an apartment because, again, my disability was not going to kick in. I was approved. However, there was a timeline involved. And in the process of that timeline, Northwest Pilot Project took care of me. And, you know, that was the biggest shot in my life, and pride more than anything, is to have someone help me like that. If there would have been some funds available through all this qualifying and everything else, because I do realize disability has millions and millions of people signing up every day and they can't blast through stuff like that. It just don't work that way. So if the funds are available to keep that person on the level and if he's getting back pay, then, you know, this could be a positive thing. But to have anyone to go through from experiencing a good lifestyle, living well, not rich, just living well, bills paid, food in the fridge, and then to lose all that, and then to have to sell your personal items just to buy bread or groceries or whatever, was such a physical jolt to me. I mean, I'm still having problems with it. I finally got stomached enough to deal with those issues, and you know, I'm just trying to move forward as best I can. Now that my disability's kicked in, I'm not on top of the world. I'm far from that. but I, for the first time, I could be proud enough to walk up to my landlord and hand him a check, look people like Jessica in the eyes, and feel proud enough to say, you know, I don't need nothing today, Jessica. I'm just here to say thank you for all your help. So these are the things, you know, that if there's a positive step in any direction to eliminate this, it would be a plus. Because stepping back, it you know, we're in an age of baby boomers, and doggone it, we're all getting older now, and we're going to be coming on, and there's many, many, many of us. We're going to need help, and that help's going to fall back on people that work every day. And it's going to fall back on organizations that need to help in one direction with money but can't due to the other direction. So I'm not the smartest person around, but I do realize if there's anything that I can do in a positive direction, I will be the first one to do it because I needed help and I received it. And thank you folks very much for listening to me, and have a good day.
Thank you, Ron. Any questions for Mr. Deason? Thank you so much. Carolyn, what a beautiful name.
Good afternoon. My name is Carolyn Sterling, and I became disabled in 1996. I was assaulted while I was at my job. And workman's comp, we went through that. It's a whole, it's like a staircase of everything that you have to do to get your workman's compensation benefits. And then finally, after 10 years, I received that. In the meantime, I had to depend on my husband for so much. I depend on him for almost everything because of the assault. I also have post-traumatic stress disorder, which keeps me from going out by myself or doing anything along the lines by myself. During the period of time where I've been disabled, I have applied for the Social Security benefits 2 times and was denied. And then 2010, I spent 5 months of that calendar year in the hospital having surgeries and trying to recover my spine from more destabilization. During all of this, Joel and I saw a decline in the way that we lived. Everything became more burdensome. You know, we had more that we needed to look out for, to watch out for. And finally, 2011, we had just run out of absolutely everything. We had done all that we could to keep our living expenses down so we could support ourselves. But we even bought a fifth wheel and moved into that for well over a year to have the cost of living even decrease more so we could buy things like the medication and doctor's bills and things like that. 2011, we saw the end of everything that we had. We had sold everything. We'd absolutely tried to support ourselves, and it just ran out of everything completely. Nothing. Joel had read about Northwest Pilot Project, and so we went to them. But it wasn't until actually sleeping outside for 2 nights that we went ahead and did that. And if it hadn't been for Northwest Pilot Project, it was still almost another 9 months before my Social Security would be approved. They helped us with our rent. We took advantage of the food card. We did have that. We had never done that before. I'm sorry, this is very emotional for me. During all of this period of time, if there had been something like this general fund where we could have applied and we could have taken care of ourselves, even by the bare necessities of that $7.10 a month, you have no idea what that means. Would you have nothing? And I mean nothing, ladies and gentlemen. Joel and I, when we got a card or from Fred Meyer or the dollar store, it was like a celebration because we had nothing. Now, it's funny how we were talking about how things happen. We were approved for this HUD housing January. We moved in January 15th. And about a month later, we heard that my Social Security was going to be approved. Mm-hmm. And so this will be the first month that we've been able to actually pay for our own rent, pay for things that we're going to need. But for that period of time of over a year of having nothing, this fund could have been so beneficial for the people like us that could have really used it and wouldn't have had to go to a charity to help us not have to live on the street. I can't explain to you how important this would be if there's any possibility that this fund could be started again. And thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much. Any questions of Carolyn?
I just want to thank you for your courage and saying that I'm really sorry for your misfortune, but I do appreciate your coming and sharing your story, because I think that's what, like I said, is very courageous, but it'll also help us to understand better. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you for coming. I noticed in both cases you both referenced an extreme amount of time that it took the workman's comp to come through. In your case, it was 10 years. And
my case, it was 2, ma'am.
2 years. So this is a question. This is a state run. Why is it taking so long for the workman's comp to settle these claims? Just a comment. I don't know either.
Is there anyone in the audience who was signed up to testify who can answer that? If not, we will find out. Thank you. And we can put that on.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's someone in the back who could.
You work for Workman's Comp?
No, I don't work for Workman's Comp, but I actually went through myself, and they fight it every step of the way.
Thank you. Okay, we will.
Is this our last panel?
No.
On this?
No, but if you have more questions.
No, I have actually more questions that probably would be for John, because you're really with Northwest Pilot Project, so I'll hold off. Maybe ask them at the end.
Jessica, it looked like you wanted to say something.
Sure. I was just going to close with some closing thoughts and just highlight how powerful it is to hear from both Carolyn and Ron and many other people I work with that Social Security benefit check is the lifeline. It is, the SSI check is just $710, but it is what pays for rent, an electricity bill, a bus pass to get to medical appointments, $4 prescriptions, and that's about it. And it is all the difference. Ron nor Carolyn have ever been burdens to our agency, and none of the people we serve are burdens. We love the work that we do and being able to work with as many as we can, but the need here is that there aren't enough resources in our agency or agencies like ours to meet the need of so many disabled people throughout Oregon who have this extended wait. And so that's why we're here, hoping our stories help you to help us protect the most vulnerable people in Oregon. So thank you.
Thank you. And we have Melanie Calvin and Patty Whitney Wise. Thank you again for coming to testify.
It's hard to hear those stories. I am a small business owner out of Portland, and I have a really unusual niche. My name is Melanie Calvin. I'm based in Portland, but I do this unique service all over Oregon. I help people with severe disabilities navigate the complex Social Security disability process. Because it's so complex, the application itself is usually not started very effectively, because people with severe disabilities need the help to get it done right. I've been doing this work about 11 years.
I hear all kinds of stories. It's hard to hear such personal stories, though, outside my office. I know how badly this kind of help is needed all over the state, especially since General Assistance Case Management was defunded in 2005. I have represented the indigent as a non-attorney advocate in each of the committee, your committees, each of these committee members' districts. I checked. A really high percentage of cases are not approved nationwide at the initial stage of this case if people don't have help. On the other hand, a really high percentage of cases, a high percentage of success is achieved when they do have help from the very beginning of the process. Rural Oregonians in particular are pretty hard hit because of the fewer amount of social services in rural Oregon. And of course, the indigent in rural Oregon very definitely fall through the cracks. So the crux of my message to you guys is when GA was funded, the case managers that helped with this process knew the Social Security criteria inside and out. And what I want you to know is that the private sector, when it went away, did not pick up this work. They still are not picking up, filling this social service gap. My focus in my practice is to help these cases started correctly. My motto is get it right the first time. And I'm certain that all the case managers that worked with General Assistance back in the day had the same feeling about their caseloads. We try really hard to avoid this two-year appeal process. When GA was in place, the applicants had, I already said that, I'm sorry. So I was going to have another fellow join me today. His name was Louis Lorkey, and he is a very sweet guy who was a previous client of mine, and he was going to come up and testify with us all the way from Coos Bay, where he has two bad knees, 60-year-old logger, and he's in a lot of pain. We just won his case recently, but he also called me up and said, you know, it's really hard for a proud guy like me to tell my story in front of people I don't know. I never expected to hit the hard times that I did. And what I learned is that his family, he has a nephew who cares dearly for him, who's a new attorney, a young attorney down in Eugene, and they were going to come up together, and he called him at the last minute and said, I don't think I can do it. But he gave me permission to tell you a little more about him. He has a blown out shoulder from all of his pull and chain and two bad knees, and the only way he survived the wait period for his disability benefits was through the help of his family, and his employer that he worked for years kept giving him odd jobs so he wouldn't lose his place. They became friends over the years, of course. Temporary state cash assistance would have eased the burden for them, of course, and the great part is that when we won his case, that retroactive award gets reimbursed to the state.
That's so important. I want you to understand this.
That's what we were listening for.
Yes, right. So repeat that.
Okay.
Because it's so important. It ends up not costing the state anything to provide this because we get paid back when SSI pays. They will pay it from the time they applied. Is that correct?
Is that true of workers' comp, too? That's what we were wondering over here.
Well, when Chairman Tomei asked that question, workers' comp was my first iteration almost 30 years ago. And I can tell you that in the Social Security process, if there's a workers' comp claim that is, you know, that the person became permanently disabled with, that retroactive money goes back to the workers' comp insurance company. It's like a lien on their Social Security benefits. It's the same for long-term disability policies, too. I won't go into that too much more because it's not really my realm of expertise, but...
We'll save it for you.
Yeah. But I will say that again. This temporary state cash assistance benefit, when the people prevail, does get reimbursed to the state. So those who are destitute, stricken with injury or disease, or downtrodden from mental illness, we know that so many people that are homeless, the percentage is so high for mental illness, they so often do not have a voice with which to speak to you as I do. I am truly honored to be that voice. I feel terrible about my clients that suffer months and months and years and years. It makes me wake up every day ready to fight harder for them. Thank you very much.
So, Melanie, what percentage of people get approved on the first application?
Okay, I actually know all that stuff.
Good.
One-third of Americans that apply for disability benefits are approved at the initial stage. It is a multi-tiered process of administrative law, and there are four tiers that literally can take 4 to 6 years to get through. The first tier, so out of those two-thirds that are denied, and I will give you some statistics, 3.5 million new claims a year are filed nationally. So two-thirds are denied out of the first gate within the first 2 to 4 to 6 months. Only one-third of those people appeal and then get into that multi-year appeal process. So it does impact millions of people. And general assistance, it seems like the one public program that could help bridge that gap. And it's temporary state assistance.
Any other questions of Melanie before we... Representative Kenny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm curious about your business. How many people are there out there like you? What was the niche you filled prior to... You started 2011, and yet this program was in existence 8 years ago, up until 2005. So there were case managers doing the kind of work you're doing. So I'm curious about what your niche was then. It's clear what your niche is now. How many people are out there like you? How are you reimbursed?
Great questions. So I've been doing this type of work for 11 years. And in 2008, I helped start a team of non-attorney representatives in Portland, and they're going strong. And to date, they have helped over 700 homeless, indigent, really tough cases that don't have a lot of good medical documentation. They're going strong. But I do want to let you know that there are very few non-attorney representative operations out there nationwide. It is a national model program, and it is an attempt for the private sector to help with this, but it is just a drop in the bucket for the need. So I go all over Oregon, and I talk to social service agencies all over Oregon, and everywhere the need is just tremendous. There are thousands and thousands of presumptive Medicaid claims out there, or, you know, applications, and I know that there are two hearings offices for the Social Security Administration here in Oregon. One is in Portland and one is in Eugene, and both offices are sitting on a backlog of 2,000 cases each. So that's 4,000 people right there that have already waited probably close to 2 years to have a one-hour hearing in front of an administrative law judge. Mm-hmm. And the need is great. So I started a second team of non-attorney reps, and I'm doing an experiment. I'm doing a fee-for-service experiment. But to be perfectly honest, to be sitting here in front of you is not in my pecuniary interest. It's just too important. Mm-hmm. If I win the case faster, mm-hmm. I get a lesser fee. I can only focus on the Social Security case and maybe some Medicaid paperwork. but I can't do the other case management. Mm-hmm. I carry a very small and intense caseload, and I carry a rolling 50 to 60 cases mm-hmm. because we work them so thoroughly in the beginning of the case. Did that answer all of your questions?
Yeah, and one other. And who pays for you? Does it come out of the SSDI?
I get paid out of that retroactive benefit.
I see.
Because that retroactive benefit is based on how long it takes to get through the system.
Mm-hmm.
So, again.
So you're paid more if it takes longer?
Yes.
Right. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for your questions, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony and for the people who testified, the witnesses before. So we got two-thirds of the cases were not settled in right away. What percentage, we had an example of 2 years and 10 years. Can you give us sort of, you know, how many get in the first 2 years, how many in 10, how many never get settled? And you know, we hate to admit this, but there are some fraud cases, right? Isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure how to answer that. The statistics that I gave you are national numbers, national averages. I'm more familiar with Oregon. And in Oregon, it does take 15 to 18 months to get a hearing, and that's after the first...
For the appeal.
For the hearing appeal in front of an administrative law judge. So the first two layers of state-level review, you know, that's 2 to 6 months as well. So I would say it is a very safe average that it takes 2 years to get on benefits for those, for the one-third of the two-thirds that got denied. In other words,
those are the fast track.
Two-thirds of the claims are denied at the initial stage, and only one-third of those people appeal and get into the appeals process.
That's right. Thank you very much.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, thank you. Patty.
Thank you. Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Task Force, and we've been part of the coalition for many years to try to restore general assistance program. And if I could just add a couple of pertinent facts. When this was eliminated in 2005, that meant that those people who had case managers at the state level to help them get through the process no longer had help. Many of them disappeared into the woods. You heard some of the living in the cars, many different ways of surviving because there was no monthly benefit to help them and no assistance to apply for the federal benefits. So we not only lost people into the woods, but we lost a lot of federal money that could have come into the state had those folks had help in applying for and getting those federal dollars to come into Oregon. Furthermore, living in the woods or in your car leads to deteriorating health. And if we ever want our CCO model to actually succeed, we're going to have to do something about this big population that needs that help, or they're going to bankrupt through using the emergency rooms, just like is happening now. So there are other ties to programs in our state that, beyond just getting the reimbursement back for us from this monthly benefit we give to the clients, there are other benefits to the state of actually doing something about this situation. So I just really urge you to pass the bill, to get this work group together, to come up with a good plan on how we can do this in the best way possible. And I will go back to when Representative Greenlick, who was on this committee during the interim, said maybe we ought to bond this. And the reason I throw that out is because the problem with getting this reinstated is it's going to cost more money up front. We have to put the money up front, and it may take a year or two before those cases bring in the money to reimburse the state. And from that point on, it's not so expensive. But remember, you have those first 2 years of startup where you're paying out the money before it's coming back from the retroactive SSI. So maybe not bonds, but some way of helping to acknowledge that there's a startup cost, but then the state saves a lot of money. And I would wager that the state will save a ton more money in health care and other expenses by putting back in place a program like this. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat.
Madam Chair, to that question.
Yes.
Thank you for that statement. So did the good representative say then, so we're going to create the bond, but the money we get back is going to pay the bonds. There's really going to be no money to the general fund.
You know, I don't know bonds, but it just struck me when he said that. I thought, well, that's one way of getting some money up front when it's an upfront cost that then you can pay back. So some system, I know we're short on money in the state, but some way of helping to put those upfront costs there to get this program back running, knowing that a lot of it will get paid back.
I don't want to get too off track, though, because that's not in this bill that we're going to be looking at today. But it's a good idea, Patty, but I don't want us to start getting worried about that. Representative Gilley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. And, Patty, this is a comment or question for you. And John Mullen said he was going to stay close by, so he might have a comment, too. But, Madam Chair, we've heard this before, and our coalition has been very patient. It's very hard to understand, from my perspective, a program like this that is, in my view anyway, a fundamental safety net, and there are a few, but this is an important one, strangely got put aside, and there are great costs to get it going again, and we've heard about that. So I appreciate that. I would say this, that I think Representative Whitsitt almost answered her own question when she said, what's the problem with workers' comp? Isn't it a state agency? But that's another subject. I think that your reaching out, your patience, and your perseverance to this is an important thing, because I think it was beautifully demonstrated by the people that testified how important this is for our most vulnerable friends and neighbors. And I appreciate that you put in the advisory group, I'll sing a familiar refrain, that you put nonprofits and community organizations such as are in the room, you've been with us before. What can we do besides just putting the membership on it in your thinking and framework of this to encourage more of that so that those funds that we do leverage through the federal government, we all pay for those, we ought not to leave those on the table, I get that, but that we can leverage more of these services now when we have an opportunity to start over so that delivery comes through more community-based organizations?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, that's an excellent question. And one of the things, of course, what this bill is about is creating an advisory committee that represents the different departments as well as other community stakeholders. We're hoping that when people get together and they talk about the need and they talk about the impact in systems, that not only the discussion about general assistance, but other ideas will also emerge about how to do this. Now, the two folks that came down with Jessica Larson from Northwest Pilot Project, I've been a fan of Northwest Pilot Project for decades and can tell you that there's not a Northwest Pilot Project in every corner of the state. And so to the extent that the private sector, nonprofit sector can be involved, we would like to see that happen. But the public response is also necessary as well. So we envision a lot of really important discussions happening in this advisory committee.
And Madam Chair, if I could follow up quickly. I don't know if you all were in the room when the director here, Aaron Kelly Seal, was here talking about how, and I was heartened by this, about how important private partnerships are to DHS in other matters. And so I think you've got a director who's open to this, and I look forward to passing the bill and also talking about these issues as the group gets going.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions? So, John, again, just tell us briefly what this bill does. It does not restore general assistance.
That's right, Madam Chair. Again, as I mentioned back in 2011 when I talked to the co-chairs then, that there wasn't the resources to get the program refunded, and we didn't hear the bill. So we said, well, let's take a different approach, and we'll get people together that can really weigh in and talk about the impacts in other systems. We have talked to people in the Department of Corrections and ODVA, and as well as Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. Getting those folks together across departments as well as all of the others that are mentioned, the stakeholders, will give us, I think, the best opportunity to take a look at how we can use the resources that we have and then make the request for what is needed in the future. Also in the bill is the potential that we could come back to the 2014 session recommending a pilot project.
Great. Any further questions?
Can I just make a comment, Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
As a new legislator, it's exceedingly frustrating to see how long that would take. You're talking about 2014 legislature to even try to start something up, which would presumably, you know, not start until at least July 1st, 2014.
Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Guyer, if I might, that was a frustration for us as advocates. We see the need right now, and yet we knew that we didn't have a powerful enough discussion or consensus, I should say, in 2007 and 2009 to refund the program. So we hope that what will come forward from the advisory committee will be so compelling that we will get this funded again.
Any further questions? Representative
Just
Guyer.
Another comment. Talk about how long things take. Actually, one of my first community organizing jobs was with Northwest Pilot Project. What was Peter's last name?
Peter Paulson.
Paulson, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Remember
started the... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank
you.
Thank you.
A group, I think.
Yeah. Any further comments, questions? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2712. Colleagues, I'm going to open up a work session on 2712 so we can talk about it. So normally I suggest that we wait until our next meeting to have a work session. I'm so compelled by this. I guess I'd like to have a work session now, and I want to know what the mood of the committee is.
Can we stand at ease for 1 minute?
Yes, we can stand at ease. Thank you. And then House Bill 2712. Colleagues, we also have lots of written testimony.
Oh, I'm still
you probably
names.
Have
I'm
that
sorry.
In your files. And I'm waiting for my script.
Julie.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, do you want to do this? Let him do it, okay?
How about it?
Okay.
Either way. We can co-move.
Is this part ready to go?
That part is ready to roll.
Okay.
With feeling.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I'd like to move House Bill 2712 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill will be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
By prior reference.
By prior reference, yes. That's
okay. Representative David Gombert moves that House Bill 2712 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? I think we all wish it could be more, but it's a step, and it's the first step that we've been able to push through in all the 13 years that I've been in this building. So I'd really like to get one step, even if it's not a very big step. Any further discussion? All right. Those of the opinion that House Bill 2712 be reported to the Those are the Ways and Means Committee first, doesn't it?
Ways and Means.
To the Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, we'll vote aye and the opposed no. And Debbie, would you take the roll, please?
The railroad.
Representative
Gallegos? Aye.
Representative
Elster? Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Wisman?
Aye.
Representative Woodson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gombert?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye.
Yeah, look at that.
With all the infirmities.
Oh, roger that. Affirmative.
Right. This bill passes. So congratulations, John. We finally got something through. Congratulations to all of you people that came. We've been working on this, as I said, the 13 years that I've been in the legislature.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
It's not even 6 years.
Thank you. Thank you, committee. I appreciate that. David, do you want to carry this? You look like you might be...
Well, I was going to say something else, but I'll be happy to take care of it.
Oh, go ahead.
If you're attached to it, otherise I would love it. I'd be honored to do it.
I defer.
So do we have to wait for Ways and Means?
Ways and Means?
Yeah, we're going to have to wait first.
And then we get to carry it, right? So then I have a request. Okay. Okay, the work session is closed on House Bill 2712. Now we're going to open up House Bill 2349. And is Representative Fagan here?
She's gone.
Yeah.
Okay.
She had a carpool, a baby.
Madam Chair, I think one of the issues that we had that you and I hadn't really gone into great detail about, and why Andy's here right now, is the Dash 1 amendments on this whole issue. I have some concern where League of Oregon City...
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2349 has a revenue statement that was issued and no fiscal impact statement. It does have an amendment and a subsequent referral to tax credits.
Okay.
And it extends the tax exemption for single-unit housing to 2025.
Okay, great. Okay. And do we have anybody else signed up to testify, Debbie? Okay. Oh, that's right. It is a work session. Okay. So did I open up the work session? Okay. All right. Go ahead.
The Chair Tomei and Representative Olson, Andy Smith for the City of Portland. Happy to talk about the conversations that we've had with the counties on this. Of course, we work closely with Multnomah County on our local program, and now that the amendment's been proposed that removes the requirement that this program apply in distressed areas, there's a potential that other cities and other locations could potentially be using this. The concern that AOC raised was that because 51% of the taxing authorities in a particular area have to agree on an abatement program for it to be used under this program, that in some parts of the state, one city may actually have that weight and then wouldn't have to consult with a county prior to authorizing it. So in my conversations with AOC, we're open to figuring out how you know, we can put some sideboards on it to make them comfortable. There was a couple proposals that we discussed and haven't been able to quite figure it out yet, but I think that their concerns were at a low enough level where they were comfortable moving it out of this committee and continuing to discuss the issue with us and seeing if we can figure something out. As for the League of Cities, I haven't had any conversations with them. I don't think that they have any issue with this at all.
So I interrupted you, Representative.
I mean, at this point right now, Madam Chair, I'm okay with moving the bill forward without the dash ones, but if we're going to move the dash ones, I really want to explore a little bit more to have somebody from League of Oregon Cities here. And also, I'd like to have somebody from Association of Oregon Counties here. I mean, I think we got to dig into it a little bit more, especially on the dash ones. But I appreciate, Andy, your sharing.
I had heard that there was another amendment. No, you haven't. You heard that too, Representative Penny?
I heard there might be one coming. The dash one only removes the distressed areas. Mm-hmm. That was the one that we already discussed. There was a second amendment to look at. Should this go beyond cities to unincorporated areas? That's the one that is not included, I believe, in the dash one, correct? And that's the one that would need further exploration. I feel very confident about just removing distressed areas in Amendment 1. I would be happy if we could pass that piece today. The second piece about whether we go forward and expand this to other jurisdictions, I think needs more comment. I agree.
So are we okay to pass the dash 1 amendment? I think so. But I still have a question on the homes. We talked about this, finding out how many of these homes are still being held by the original owners and how many may have gone into foreclosure, and so they're trying to get those numbers for me so I can see how is the program working after this many years. Do we want to extend it, or do we want to see what are the ramifications of the original program?
Okay.
Well, it sounds like we don't have a lot of understanding on this, and maybe we need to have another work session and maybe look and see if there are any amendments coming through. I sort of agreed with you, Representative Geyer, that it seemed to me it was good to broaden it so that it wasn't just distressed areas.
Right.
So, yeah.
Can I comment on that?
Yes.
So that was the one that Representative Shamia Fagan testified on, and you are here on her behalf. And so please invite him if I'm not clear enough. Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Friends. I work for Representative Shamia Fagan, representing House District 51. I want to apologize for her. She had to get to a really important in-district appointment. Just briefly, I just wanted to echo what Andy said. I've been in conversations with the counties, with Gil from the counties. He stopped by yesterday morning, spoke about his concern, and the three of us have been talking about it, the issue with the taxing jurisdictions. Spoke with him again this morning, and he's totally fine moving forward with the bill as is. I think if he was opposed to it, he would probably be here today to speak on that.
Bill as it is, or with the amendment?
With the amendment as is.
With the second amendment?
Is
we don't have?
We don't have one. But there was talk about one, but I haven't seen one.
There was talk about one to go beyond cities, right, into counties
unincorporated.
So maybe Danny needs to come up and say something, too.
You need to come up if you're going to speak.
What? I believe.
From our conversation, hi, I'm Danielle Ledesma. I'm with the Portland Housing Bureau. I believe that with the proposed amendment that our colleague from Multnomah County was going to work with our colleague from the Housing Alliance, John Van Landingham, to work on a different bill to sort of correct that program. It was 2022.
But not this bill.
Not this bill, but that fix would happen in a different,
because
in different legislation.
There's like five different bills that it could have impacted.
Exactly.
Do you want for me to just say something about the dash one amendment? And
sure.
So the distressed areas was basically the idea was go ahead and extend the sunset but take out that this program, property tax abatement for homeowners, could only be used in distressed areas because of the fear of are you just ghettoizing certain areas, and it's really hard on certain school districts if they have a lot of distressed area, and why not allow this to be used in other ways? The state is basically would make it more permissive to be used. The city could still decide they want to focus on distressed areas. The conversation then would happen at the city level. So all we're doing at the state is allowing a little bit wider use of the toolbox by doing this. And so it seemed like there was a lot of support for that. Is that how you understand it, Representative Olson?
That's exactly, I think that's a good description of it, Madam Chair, with what Representative Kenny Geyer said. But my point being is still, I need to have somebody from both those associations here. I'll feel a lot better about myself on how I vote and support this thing, because I do need somebody specifically from the League of Oregon Cities, their thoughts on it, and also from the counties. I mean, I'm good with where we would want to go with that. I need to have just that little extra edge.
It doesn't require them to do anything. Isn't this totally permissive? If they didn't want to.
Well, you just heard what Andy said, though, about the potential of what may happen in a county if a city has greater weight than a county. I'm curious on what they're going to say regarding that and what the impact would be for both city versus county on that. That's huge, because you do have some counties, cities, arrangements like that. That's all. I thought that was a great comment.
I think to make people more comfortable, they'd like to have somebody from the Alliance of Oregon Counties come and testify. So that works for me.
I'm happy to pull them together as soon as possible.
Okay, so we will carry over the work session on House Bill 2349. Any other questions or concerns?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just if there's a work group or a group that's formally meeting, I hope that Representative Fagan would be invited into that. And
is there a work group?
Well, I just heard a lot of conversation about people talking. I just want to make sure that we keep Representative Fagan.
Oh, absolutely.
I think she'd be better served by her LA.
Anything else?
There was a committee I've disagreed.
The work session on House Bill 2349. Did I excuse you, Representative Olson?
Yeah, I'll be right
back. Representative Olson, did you get excused?
No, I was just going to say goodbye to somebody here really quick, Madam Chair.
Exactly. The work session on House Bill 2349. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Earlier, when you guys were doing the motion, you, I think, unnecessarily, and I must say in a hurtful way, mentioned David Gomberg's whole name. And I don't recall you ever mentioning my whole name or Andy's whole name.
I am reluctant to mention your name at all.
Apparently, I'll never learn.
Anything else for the good of the order?
Yes, Madam Chair. Gomberg. Yes.
Gomberg. Yeah. He's got me all flustered.
Did you say Goldberg? Madam Chair, if I could say, my head is still spinning at the fact that my first name has been mentioned by two members of the committee here now. But nonetheless, I would like to move to suspend the rules and reopen the work session on 2053 so that Representatives Gillum, Gelster, and Olson can vote on that.
Okay. Any objection to that? If not, I will open up the work session on House Bill 2053. So, Debbie, I think you'll have to call their names again.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative
Gilliam? Aye.
And Vice Chair Olson?
See?
With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2053.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure that Vic, Sarah, and Andy got a chance to vote.
Thank you very much.
Daniel, thank you so much.
David.
With that, I close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.